have a minute before Ethelbert Miller comes our way with On the Margin. And again, we implore you to go to the phones and pledge your support. Still in need of $930 for Democracy Now. We appreciate your support. Again, a riveting interview there. And we need more. We need you to support Democracy Now. Freedom is not free. Many hands do indeed make light work. And we are courageous in ensuring you get this information, as is Democracy Now. So 800-222-9739. As we move very quickly to On the Margin, you are in tune to WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Wayne Carlin. Wayne Carlin is an editor and fiction writer living in Maryland. His most recent book is A Genera. How are you doing this morning, Wayne?
Good morning, Ethelbert. Doing well. How are you?
Okay, we have a lot to discuss. We're having our fundraising going on right now at WPFW, and we're going to be encouraging people to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 during this hour of conversation. When you were last on my show, we discussed your book, Memorial Days, Vietnam Stories, 1973 to 2022. Do you remember that discussion?
Yeah, very well.
Okay. Your new book opens with a quote from Tim O'Brien. You quote him as saying, "Stories can save us." Did writing your new book save you in any way? And did it resolve any issues you had been carrying for a while?
It was an attempt to do that. I think that's one of the things that triggered the book. I had, because of certain personal losses, and also because of many things disturbing happening in the world. And so on. I was kind of losing faith in the ability of words to make a difference in the world, which as a writer is a kind of deep wound to carry. So in a sense, writing this novel was an attempt to write my way out of that feeling.
Expand on that, Wayne, because, many of us are writers. There's a lot going on in the world. Some of us are becoming more engaged in things because of what's going on. But then some of us are saying, like, okay, I reached a point, I'm seeing so many things that are so disturbing, I can't write. How do you get through that?
I mean, it goes to the essence of our craft and our vocation. And if you're a writer who feels as I do that my writing has always been in a sense an attempt to be part of the Jewish tradition of Tikkun Olam, of fixing the world. There's a lot to be fixed in the world, and a lot that is not being fixed when that becomes part of personal loss, also is a sense of futility that I was feeling. In a sense, it's something I think I wrote about in the first chapter, which is almost a nonfiction chapter of the book. I keep writing about terrible things, and started to have a kind of mystical sense. What if my writing is just evoking this stuff, is adding to it, is creating it rather than trying to heal and deal with it.
How difficult is it being a Jewish writer right now? I look at what's going on in terms of Israel and Gaza, and we look at our college campuses, we look at our communities. There seems to be a considerable divide. Where are Jewish writers like yourself in the midst of this discussion?
I don't know. I can't speak for all Jewish writers, definitely, right. but I mean, it's obviously a time for the Jewish community as a whole, dealing with the tragedies and the horrible things that have happened both in Israel and in Gaza and Palestine, and trying to not balance, but formulate the way we should react to that, how we feel about it.
Talk about the title of your book, The Genocide. It seems as if I was dealing with the marketing, I look at how, if I see this book in a bookstore, the word seems like it specifically deals with a Jewish audience, but you made a decision to use this in such a way in terms of how it shapes your book. So why don't you define for our listeners what the genocide is?
Yeah, it's pronunciation would be more Geniza. And it's a cache for books and documents that contain any kind of religious holy script that in the Jewish tradition, these can't be, when the books become old and worn, they can't be destroyed. They have to be basically ceremoniously mourned, and in a sense, a funeral given for them. So the books were kept in places like, there might be a cellar or what I describe in the first chapter of the novel is a cache that was inside a wall. It's literally something that we found when I was with some friends inside an old abandoned yeshiva building, and within there you find all of these old books and documents. So for me, that sense of where it goes back to what we're talking about, that sense of the words being literally, in this case, walled up, put inside a wall, and carrying the latent power of words that even creating such a space for them indicates that the words have a power that they. They can be buried, and if they are buried, they do no good. How do you deal with them? How do you put them out in the world? Mm-hmm. So the image that I describe in that first chapter is of those words kind of coming out of the wall, coming out of the place where they're buried.
Mm. I know that many times they not just books, but there's also sacred objects that are put aside. And my question to you, Wayne Carlin, is: are stories sacred objects?
Okay, I had a little trouble hearing that.
I said, are stories sacred objects? Sometimes it's not just books that are put in storage, but also sacred objects.
There's a line in a Muriel Rukhauser poem that the world is made of stories, not atoms. Stories are our lives. I mean, stories, again, in that Tim O'Brien sense, can save us. And you think of the word save that he uses in that. He's talking, that's from a story where literally he is... mourning the death of a girl he knew who died, the character knew at least, who died of cancer, and he's saving her life by creating a story about her, not her physical life because she's gone, but saving her in that sense. And then stories save us in many other ways. They can save the person we want to be. They can save our memories. They can create life. So, yes, they're sacred.
What? I'm going to take you back in time. Why did you go to Poland in 1993? What was happening in your life at that time?
Well, my mother had just passed away, and I went to the. I was going to the town that she came from, that had where the Jewish population had been completely massacred during the Holocaust in a few weeks period. So I'd been planning to do that, and I'd gotten a NEA grant that year, so I could afford to do it. So those two things came together, and it was also I went right after I had met with in the University of Massachusetts with these Vietnamese writers who had been on the other side of the war, which was a very, emotional experience for me. So it somehow all came together. The Vietnamese sense of dealing with the dead as if they're still with you, as if they're living, and the fact of my mother just passing away, and I have a photograph of my grandfather, her father's grave site in that town. So, I mean, literally, I was going to visit that grave, which in fact doesn't exist anymore because the Jewish cemetery had been, completely plowed over, basically after the Holocaust.
Talk about your trip that you took. This would result in your book, Rumors and Stones. About that book, because it seems that that's a book that sort of relates to your newest book.
Yeah, that one went into the other. Well, in Rumors and Stones, it was an account of that trip to Poland. And at the same time, so it was a nonfiction book, but at the same time, I included as fictional pieces stories that my mother had told me about her life growing up in that town, and I always felt like those stories, needed to be told and needed to be told in, I don't know, I'm not going to say needed to be told in a different context. It's when I decided to do this book, The Geniza, which was triggered by several other things that I felt like I wanted to continue the stories that had come from my mother's life, but in a different way, in a different context in this book. So
okay.
I had, I guess a year or two ago, with what there was research that I couldn't do back in the early 90s because of the internet, I was able, the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem has a website where you can, you can go on and find the names of people who had been killed in the Holocaust. And in doing that and putting in, the name of my mother's town and our family name, I had found, what I knew it had happened. I knew what the family had been left behind and all been killed, but I didn't know the number or a lot of the names of those family members. Mm-hmm. So I found through that website, there were over 30 names of people who had been killed in my mother's town and in the neighboring town where my family was from as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to wait, Carl. I'm going to take a little. I'm going to take a little break
that happens,
here.
It just started me.
I'm going to take a little break here, and I'm going to introduce Katia Sid to you. She's going to help us pitch this hour in terms of doing our fundraising, encouraging people to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Kati, are you there?
I am right here. Good morning, Ethelbert. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
It's nice to be with you both. And, of course, you all know what to do. Ethelbert produces such a fine show. He introduces us to writers, poets that we may or may not know. And we always learn something. It's always insightful. It's always relevant. It's always poignant. And sometimes funny, even. Ethelbert can be funny. You know that.
Well, that's and, Wayne knows that, too.
And Wayne knows that, too, exactly. And, you know, of course, we are honored to have an exceptional writer and poet hosting this program in the form of E. Ethelbert Miller. So if this is appointment listening for you, we urge you now to go to the phone or go to the computer and make that call or click that makes the difference. The number to call is 202-588-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. There's always a Cash App option, which is $WPFWFM. We have a modest goal this morning of $500, and we can do that together, folks. We say it a lot, but it's so true that many hands do make light work. Perhaps you'll consider becoming a sustaining member at the $10, $20, $50, $100 level. If someone becomes a sustaining member right now at the $50 level, that will place us over our goal. And Ethelbert will be very happy because he can just continue with this wonderful conversation. And so please do your part. WPFW and On the Margin, this is a call and response. So we put out the call by doing the programming, sending you this information, ensuring that it's transmitted clearly, ensuring we have the best hosts and producers like E. Ethelbert Miller and programming like On the Margin. And then you respond by supporting us. This is people-powered radio. We are not funded by the corporations or the government. We are funded by you, literary lovers, folks just like you who want to hear this content. So the number again, 202-588-9739 or online at WPFWFM.org, $500 to go. And Ethelbert, I hope to, if you allow me to, I will rejoin you later in the program to thank
you. Yes, you're calling us literary lovers. That's so sweet of you. We love you madly.
Oh, love you more.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, Katia. Wayne, I want to ask you something because you were correcting me, or well, you should have corrected me. Mention the title of your book, because of what happened. I was looking at this as Genesa. How is it correct? What's the correct pronunciation?
Yeah, you're not the only one. Believe me. I've had some very strange pronunciations. Genesa.
Okay, we'll have that. Okay, so that's the title. Genesa is the title of the book. One of the things I thought is very important for us to discuss, Wayne Carlin, is the city that you go back to in 1993, the city where your mother was. It's Colno, correct?
Yeah, it's a small town.
Yeah. Talk about its actual location, because I think that's important. And then, you know, expand on what happened in 1941, because in your book, in chapter 20, I found that chapter, which is called Lenin's Funeral. That's a very difficult, I was wondering, that's a difficult chapter to read. And I was wondering how difficult it was to write.
Yeah, it's very, to answer your question in a word. What happened? Well, let me kind of frame that by saying what I tried to do in the book was, because I had learned and actually saw the names of the people who had been killed in that town of relatives. I decided to, it just triggered this idea. Well, what if my parents had never left Europe? What if my mother had never left that town? I know what would happen to her. She would have died with the rest of them there. And what would have that been like? It's the kind of thing we all come to in our in our lives when we think, well, if we did this instead of that, if I'd gone that way instead of this way. I know what would have happened to my mother, which was this. I mean, what happened in the town and in that chapters when the Germans occupied the town in 1941, they with the help, unfortunately, of a lot of the Poles who lived there also. It was a majority Jewish town, but it had a Polish population too. It started as usual restrictions and then kind of pogroms, and it led eventually within weeks for the entire Jewish population that had survived the first murders to be driven out of the town in trucks and put into dishes and machine gunned to death. It was 3,000 people. The Lenin's funeral happened, you know, just before that, and it took place in the cemetery where my grandfather's grave and other ancestors' graves were. Soviets had occupied that town before the when Poland had been, given half of it given to the Soviet Union with the Hitler-Stalin Pact in 1939, and they'd erected a statue to Lenin. When Lenin's funeral happened, the Germans basically ordered the Jews to come to the town square to tear down that statue and to take it to the cemetery and bury it. And they had the whole population out there. And as they were, as they tore down the chapter, people were being shot and people were being taken out of the procession, beaten to death, stabbed to death. Girls were being raped. It was a horrible scene. It was kind of a pogrom with the Germans in charge, but with the Poles carrying out the murders and rapes at that time. And under those conditions, they were all taken to the cemetery where the statue or the rubble of the statue was buried while that was going on. And then they were told, get out of here, flee. There's, whoever's left standing on the street will be shot. So it was a horrible event, but it led to more horrible events within days, literally where everybody was just ordered to come to the town square again and then separated by gender and taken out of the town and put into ditches and shot to death.
I know that happened to my family,
and if my mother had stayed there, that would have happened to her.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, we're talking about the writing of this chapter 20, but I'm looking at how you went to Vietnam. You saw a lot of things, in terms of the war there. Are you combining things in terms of things that you've experienced, things that you're reading, things that you're imagining? I mean, how is all that coming together?
Well, I'm imagining it as a writer. It has echoes, and I put some of them into the last chapter, of course, of events like My Lai in Vietnam, which I never saw any. When I was there, I didn't participate in anything like that, but it was part of my war, and I understood it very well, and so I can't imagine people being murdered, machine gun in a ditch in Poland, which literally happened to my family, without thinking of the Vietnamese put into a ditch in My Lai and killed in the same way. It's a history that has to be connected, for me in that way.
Mm. I was wondering. I mean, this is sometimes. I'm just wondering in terms of. Of you're listening to the stories of your mother. I want to go back and talk about that for a minute. But I'm just wondering in terms of, can you be writing something that you get so deeply involved in that you're almost experiencing trauma?
Yeah, I think you can't. I think that's the price you pay for writing stuff like that. It's the price that you have to pay if you're going to make the fiction real. So I would be a monster if I could just imagine all that stuff happening without feeling it, without mourning it.
You know, I was reading Ta-Nehisi Coates' most recent book, The Message, and he goes back to Dakar, Senegal. And, you know, you have this whole thing of, you know, you're going back. He's, in this sense, he's going back to Africa. I was wondering how you experienced when you were going to Poland, you know, and do you feel, for example, some people say, okay, I feel the ghost here. And I'm always just curious about what's the size of the Jewish population in Kolno today?
No, there's no Jews there.
There's no Jews at all. Okay.
No, I mean,
is there any museum or monument remembering them there?
No, and that was one of the things that that was a motivation for this book. Also, when I went there, it's the Jews were a majority in that town, and they had been there for hundreds of years, and all of that happened, and it was erased. I mean, there was absolutely no, you know, the cemetery was grass with a few stones that had been graves sticking up there. The town square where, you know, I know our family's house had been on the side of that town square. There was a monument, but it was a monument to the Soviet soldiers that had liberated the town. And I remember there. I took a picture of this because somebody put the graffiti on the monument of the word Slayer in English for some reason, which was really weird. But that, you know, it stuck me. There was no indication there had been any Jewish population in town. And I felt, you know, I did feel an obligation to name them and commemorate them. Through stories, through what I do, which is to write stories.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, in terms of were there any people that you were interviewing there?
When I went in '93, I tried to talk to people. They didn't, you know, there was some hostility because there was a notion that, which I'd been warned about, you know, that people had been murdered going to those small towns because people were afraid that, you know, Jews were coming back to reclaim property. And the last thing I would want to do would be reclaim property there if I knew anything about it. So most people I spoke to when I went there at that time, we don't remember anything. I don't know anything. There were three old men that I finally found, and they, you know, when I said the family name, you know, one of them said, oh yeah, he'd known Brickman's, which was, you know, the family name at that point. And those three old guys showed me, around. They showed me the old synagogue, which had been, since the war, just not used ever anymore. It had been bricked up and abandoned. And, you know, they showed me where the old Jewish school had been, and, you know, those things. So they were, they were solemn, I guess that would be the best way to describe them. It was like, they were the only ones I spoke to there who in any way wanted to indicate anything that there had been another population living in that town which had been murdered.
Mm-hmm. You know, one word that seems to appear in your book, Janisa, and also in Rumors and Stones, is the word stones. And I'm, you know, I remember growing up in New York, in the South Bronx, we had the cobblestones there. But it seems as if, you know, the stones are things that you throw, the stones are things that you are knocked down, you hit your head against. It seems like it becomes a metaphor for many things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Jewish custom to leave, when you visit a gravesite, to leave stones, pick up some stones and leave them to commemorate your visit. And the only thing I brought back from that trip to Poland, I took some stone from that synagogue building. I took the stones, you know, small stones, I'm talking about from where the cemetery had been. And I took stones. I went to what was left of the concentration camp in Treblinka. And the there's a road there that was built by the inmates, by the people in the concentration camp, you know, as slave labor. And in that road, which goes on for miles, I mean, it's basically they had put in Jewish gravestones and other stones, and it was all still the ash from the crematoria had settled into those stones, and that ash was still there. So I took a stone from there, and those were the, you know, I brought home those three stones. That was the only commemoration of my trip.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're going to take a little break, Wayne Carlin. I'm talking to Wayne Carlin. He's the author of this new book called The Geniza. That's G-E-N-I-Z-A-H. We'll get the spelling correctly. The show's on the margin. My name's E.S. Burt Miller. The station's WTFW 89.3 FM.
Fall is a time of change and impermanence. What never changes is WPFW's unwavering commitment to providing reliable news, informative public affairs, and exceptional music that inspires both action and introspection. From October 14th through November 3rd, we celebrate The Circle Unbroken, 47 years of being in the community with WPFW during our Fall Pledge Drive. We invite you to be in community and solidarity with us by making a donation at WPFWFM.org to ensure that this independent grassroots media outlet not only survives, but thrives. It is with your generous support that we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin. And this is our fundraising. It's going on right now. And the number to call here to make a pledge is 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Wayne Carlin, your book, I think, is very important. And it's almost like a survivor story because, you know, your mother was fortunate to come to America. Talk about how... some of your family came to America. Others went to Palestine. Some went to Argentina. And my question is, how was it to write this book during a time when, within the American society, there is this opposition to immigration? And I was wondering, what can one learn from your family stories?
Oh, I mean, that's yeah. If not for immigration, my family would not have survived. Obviously. The reality of their lives when they came to this country, you know, they left what for Jews were terrible conditions, segregated, impoverished, discriminated against, periodically slaughtered. And they, you know, they left that for what was the promise of America. And, you know, they came at a time when the gates were more or less open. Not more or less. They were open, you know, until they were shut again by the end of the 1920s. So they brought a lot to America. You know, I have photographs of my cousins who were came from Poland and then went back to Europe in the Second World War to fight for this country. Immigrants are the the lifeblood and the energy of the country. So,
you know, when one of the things that I think I reacted to, and this is why people immigrate, I was looking at, and this is in that chapter 20, the Lenin's funeral, where I'm looking at the response of the Polish community, where you have, you know, the Jews who are looking at, you know, they're being paraded to the streets. They're looking at people that they know, you know, people who are looking out windows, people who all of a sudden, you know, are attacking them or yelling at them. And I just wonder in terms of, one, how people are driven out of a country.
Yeah. As you know, as I just said, I mean, the conditions there, even before the Holocaust, were conditions of being discriminated against, you know, really segregated. And you know, my mother's memory is of surviving a pogrom where she and her family survived because they hid in the cellar for weeks while part of the Polish population of the town was rioting against the Jews and murdering people. I mean, people think of how terrible the Holocaust was, but you know, there were literally in Eastern Europe, in Poland, and in the Ukraine, and all those countries, there were, from the turn of the century to the 1920s and 30s, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews that were killed in these type of actions. So it was a matter of being, you know, and I should say, you know, there were Poles that they were friends with and who supported them. And, you know, in one of the last chapters of the book, I have a Polish farmer who tried to help, you know, save people. Mm-hmm. But, it's just prejudice that exists because of, seeing people as the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that one finds in your book, Wayne Carlin, is that the forest takes on this sort of almost mystical sort of place, but it's also a place in which we see what we call, I guess, the Jewish partisans, the resistance group, that people resisted.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that? Because many times, you know, that's not discussed.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things I found out in researching this book were that two of my grandmother's brother's sons, three of them had from that town had gone into the forest and were part of a partisan group. There were Jewish partisan groups that went into the forest and survived the war of fighting against the Nazis. And not ironically enough, but literally enough, there were, of course, also there were Jews who tried to join Polish partisan groups and who were killed by those groups because they were Jewish. But my cousins had they ended up in a partisan group that they fought in the forests outside of Kolno, and then finally joined up with the Soviet army, and they fought across Europe. They were part of the Soviet army that went into Berlin at the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was reading this, you know, going into the forest, I remember, I mean, it was like 1972. I went into a forest in Russia, and it was so, at night. It was one of the most frightening things. I couldn't, I just couldn't figure out how somebody would survive in a forest at night. I mean, it was just, you know, just pitch black. But I guess in terms of, you know, when you're trying to survive, that's how you adapt to the doctor. But I just found it extremely frightening.
Yeah, I don't blame you. But the other thing is, I mean, when you asked about my reactions when I went to Poland, I mean, it was just, you know, beautiful. Bucolic and beautiful in the forest it's quite beautiful, which I found disturbing because you find all this you know quite beautiful nature and you know all this death happened there, all these murders happened there. I guess you can go anywhere, mm-hmm. anywhere in the world and find that type of history, but that juxtaposition of the terrible things that had happened and the natural beauty was always jarring for me.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Wayne, was the structure of your book. You know, I felt that this was when I opened up the book, I felt I was reading a memoir, and then it became like creative nonfiction. And I was just wondering whether it's one of those books that, for example, if you're in a bookstore, you know, where do you place it? If you're on the bookstore staff, it seems like it could fit into a couple of different categories.
Yeah, well, it's fiction. Okay, but there are in the opening chapters, I come into it.
That's when I opened the book. I felt this is Wayne's story here, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, I come into it, but I come into it also as a character because, you know, it's what I come into is made up. It's fiction. I as a character, I visit this yeshiva in New York where there's a Geniza, and that leads into the rest of the story, the stories in Poland. I did have that experience. You know, I did go into, you know, it was a yeshiva in New York where with some friends we found the Geniza. But the chapter itself is, you know, it's fictionalized. It's made up.
I'm reading a
novel. You know, the whole thing is a novel. And again, my it's based on my mother and father. But it takes things that happened in their lives in Europe, but also in America. And then I imagine, you know, well, what would have been like if they had if they'd stayed in Europe? How would they have met? How would they have gotten married? How would their life have been? Before the terrible events at the end. So it's all imagining, you know, it's all stories and fiction, but.
Well,
so I understand people can be confused about that, so
right.
Okay.
Well, you talk a lot about your mother. What about your father? What stories did you hear from him?
Yeah, you know, my dad died when I was five, so there's a lot I don't know about his background. I did kind of reconnect with some people in my father's family a few years ago and got more information. But I did know from my mother's stories and from other relatives.
Let me interrupt you. Then did you imagine your father? In was that a sense in terms of you creating a father that you didn't know?
Yeah, I mean it absolutely. What I did know is that he came, you know, at a very young age from Eastern Europe. That he lived in the Lower East Side of New York. That he came from a very religious, you know, background. But he became as a young person. Growing up on the Lower East Side of New York, he became a boxer, and he was a professional boxer, and then he stopped doing that, but he always even at a time when I knew him, it was up till I was five. I mean, one of the memories I have, he would take me to Stillman Gym in New York, because he still coached Golden Gloves. So I had to imagine him, of course, but I used what I knew about his life in that imagining.
Mm-hmm. When did, this is also a thing in terms of immigration, when did your name change? Your father's changed it because it's like Karlinski, I think it was at one time?
Yeah, they changed it when they came to America.
That happens a lot, but you know, I'm thinking about sometimes in terms of people not knowing their names, but in terms of I'm just wondering whether there would be like a relative who would say, okay, I want to go back and change my name back, you know.
I don't know of any that would want to do that. I mean, the name itself, so all of we all have the American English names, but also Hebrew names. And my father also, you know, he had a Hebrew name, and that's what's on his grave. His American name, you know, Lewis, and his Hebrew name, Eliezer. And my mother, you know, the same way. So it wasn't a matter of losing those names. They were kept, but there was like one name for the, you know, for the American side, and one name for the, it was internal, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the word Karlinski, all that just means you're from Carlin.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's another word in your book that appears quite frequently, and is the correct pronunciation Dybbuk?
The Dybbuk, yeah.
The Dybbuk, yeah. Talk about the Dybbuk, which is part of like Jewish mythology, but like these evil spirits. And talk about them, because that's the term that you use to describe the people who are committing the atrocities.
Yeah, I mean, Dybbuk is an evil spirit that takes over somebody's soul. It's a possession. You're possessed by this evil spirit that then becomes you. So what you were is subsumed by that demon. And I use that imagery to think about, you know, what happened to these, you know, the thing you said before about the Polish neighbors kind of looking at this or participating in it. Well, what would make people who had been neighbors, you know, who had been living together, turn into that?
Yeah.
What turns people into demon? You know, and that happens all the time, right? That people we can look at as, you know, as normal, who are good, you know, in many ways, because of racism, because of hatred, become monsters.
Yeah. Well, we're going to move pivot from the Dybbuk to one of the angels. I'm going to bring Katia Sitt back in. Katia, are you there?
I'm right here listening to this wonderful conversation.
And we're moving from Dybbuk to you. You are an angel.
Well, I'm hoping that I can move the listeners to make that pledge of support that makes all the difference in ensuring that we have the platform that is WPFW since 1977. Members have supported to ensure that we are here and that we have a platform for beautiful programs like On the Margins, this wonderful discussion that Wayne and Ethelbert are having this morning. It is no exception. This is the kind of programming that Ethelbert always brings you, and I know you're very appreciative. So we ask you now to support that which supports you, 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. are the ways to connect to make a pledge of support. We're still in need of $500 for this hour. Won't you get us started? Won't you be the one to open the floodgates of support for On the Margin for WPFW this morning? And we have 13 minutes to do it, folks. We can do this together. Many hands make light work. Again, consider becoming a sustaining member at the $10, $20, $50, $100 level. The programmer, Ethelbert, would get the credit for the entire amount right now. And WPFW knows that it has $10 or $20 or $50 or $100 a month coming so that we can plan financially. So that is a great thing for both of us. And again, we come to you four times a year per our bylaws because we are truly listener-supported radio. And we're very proud of that fact. And you have always come through so beautifully for us. And we ask you to do it again for this fine program that is On the Margin, produced by the esteemed E. Ethelbert Miller. $500 to go. We can do this. 202-588-9739. Ethelbert?
Yeah, here's 25 bucks for me.
Thank you,
and
Wayne.
Let me say, I mean, there are so few venues for writers to get their work out to the public. It's Ethelbert's program is deeply appreciated by many of us. Support him.
Well, thank you, Wayne. You know, that's very kind of you. So now I'm going to ask you some very difficult questions.
Okay.
But, you know, I'll get back to our conversation before we end our show. I was wondering, you know, you talk about your family coming here to America. But you have relatives that went to Argentina. How were they received?
Well, they did okay there. I mean, there've been problems in Argentina with prejudice against the Jewish community, especially during the time of the disappearances and so on. But I haven't really been in much contact with them. My son did meet them when he went down to Argentina. Met a cousin who would, she had become a psychologist, so they're doing okay. But yeah, as my grandmother's brother's kids, three of them, the boys got out of Poland, went to Argentina in 1936, and then their sister went to Palestine in 1939. The mother and father and the siblings who remained in Poland, in the village of Jabłonki, which is near Kolno, were among the Jews who were put into a locked into a barn and burned alive in 1941.
What about family relatives that might have went to Russia? Because it seems that when I'm reading your book, it seems that the Jews are trapped between the Germans, the Poles, and the Russians.
Yeah, I mean that that part of Poland, you know, at times was in Russia, and the border kept, you know, the border kept shifting. But there were a number, and I bring this out in both books, really. I mean, Jews are very divided politically then as they are now, and a goodly number of them were communists, because, you know, that's when people are living under terrible conditions, they tend to become revolutionaries. So when the Soviets took over the town before the Germans came in, and you know, there were a number of people who went to Russia. And then there were also a number of people who were arrested by the Soviets and went to Russia and ended up, you know, surviving the Holocaust because they were put into Russian prisons.
Mm-hmm. When you look at your life and you look at what you've experienced in terms of, you mentioned in the beginning of this program, the personal loss. I mean, I know you lost your wife, the love of your life, for a few years ago. I'm wondering, in terms of how you, as a writer, you process loss. And I know that when you read this new book, you try to be very optimistic and hopeful. And I just wondering how that you try to achieve that type of balance.
We write. I mean, the kind of writing I do also has been writing out of wounds a lot of times. So I think Virginia Woolf had the image that the oyster forms the pearl. The only way it forms the pearl is around a wound. I mean, that's the image that goes with the question you're asking. I don't look at my writing as being primarily about healing me. I mean, it's art, so I want it to be, you know, not just for dealing with my own trauma or anything like that. But yeah, but there's a side, I guess, effect of whenever you're dealing with painful things, things that are traumatic, you need to heal in any way, you need to bring them out. You need to tell the stories about them. You need to find listeners who will listen to those stories. In some ways, so that's about, you know, it's one way that I heal. But what I'm hoping in the writing is that some of the pain is communicated, some of the trauma is communicated to to readers so that so that they feel it and feel it in a positive way, in the sense of this is something that needs to be thought of, remembered, and dealt with.
Well, how do you deal with history that, you know, I'm going back to the whole thing in terms of the title of your book, The Geniza. Some could say that maybe some stories shouldn't be disturbed. They're so sacred that they shouldn't be touched.
I don't believe that. I mean, I believe that you need to put oxygen on wounds. You need to bring it out in the world. If you don't bring it out, if I go back to that to the idea of trauma, what you don't bring out, what you don't express, continues to poison, an individual, and continues to poison a society or a culture. You know, what the evil you don't acknowledge. Am I not going to talk about American slavery? Is that going to be a healthy thing to not talk about?
Right. We'll end on that note in terms of what I think what you just said is extremely important, Wayne Carlin, and that's why I've admired you for many years. I want to encourage people to make a contribution to our station. The number here to call is 202-588-9739. The show's On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller.
Okay. Bye.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Tune in Thursdays at 1 p.m.
for the Labor Heritage Hour.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture.
As anarchist Emma Goldman said so famously, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
And that's how we feel about labor music, films,
theater, poetry,
labor history, labor art,
spoken word, basically anything that brings labor and the arts together.
So, join us for the Labor Heritage Power Hour
here on WPFW 89.3 FM.
Your station for jazz and justice.
That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement. The whole darn human
race. Friends of the Congo and WPFW invite you to Love Sound, an evening of Soul Sisters in performance on Sunday, October 20th, 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street, Southwest Washington. Performers include Free Benjamin, Wayna, Anna Mulago, Ayana Gregory, Congolese artist Deja Bell, and Maimuna Yusuf. Details including a complete list of performers at WPFWFM.org or friendsofthecongo.org. All proceeds benefit Friends of the Congo's DRC, Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa, and WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink, Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Welcome to the collision. The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Fall is a time of change and impermanence. What never changes is WPFW's unwavering commitment to providing reliable news, informative public affairs, and exceptional music that inspires.